Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today, as we continue our Voices of Wellness series, WBGO's John Kalish has the story of the Weinberg family of compassionate doctors.
I tried to keep myself healthy and deal with the brutality of working in an ER. And I don't think I always did it in a very healthy manner.
WBGO has teamed up with StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative.
Because oftentimes, you know, these voices do go unheard. It's people do their service and then that's it.
And I'll chat with the director of the doc, Bomb Bomb, The Story of Sister Nancy, to be screened as part of the Women in Media Newark International Film Festival.
I'm of the age when I was actually at the basement parties when they used to, like, drop Sister Nancy records for the first time.
All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. The Weinberg family has produced four generations of compassionate doctors since it settled in Newark more than 100 years ago. The grandson of the family patriarch has written a memoir about the family and his three decades as an emergency room and urgent care doctor. WBGO's John Kalish has the story.
We can trace the Weinberg family's medical legacy back to the early part of the 20th century, when Misha Weinberg fled the pogroms in Belarus and came to New York. He worked as a subway motorman to put himself through medical school. Then, in 1920, he moved to Newark and set up an office as a general practitioner. His son, grandsons, and a great-granddaughter followed him into the medical profession. This is all chronicled in a new memoir titled Exquisite Moments of Sorrow and Grace, written by grandson Kenneth Weinberg. His uncle, who was the youngest of Misha Weinberg's children, often went along on house calls in Newark's poor black and Jewish communities. Some of those patients were treated for free.
I thought it was amazing what my uncle told me, that when he was walking out the door, if they said to him, "Doc, how much do I owe you?" he could get a sense of how much they could afford. And if they didn't say anything to him and look down, he would not charge them because he knew they couldn't afford to pay.
That's Kenneth Weinberg, whose memoir covers his family's history in Newark and his own 30-plus year career in emergency rooms and urgent care centers, most of them in northern New Jersey. His father, Clarence, served as director of Newark City Hospital during the civil disturbances of 1967. Before that, Clarence Weinberg aided a number of Cuban physicians who fled the Castro regime and settled in the Garden State.
Here are these people who are so qualified in Cuba, but the New Jersey State Medical Board goes, no, we can't give you reciprocity. You can't become MDs. And my father then was the head of the Department of Radiology at Newark City Hospital, so he brought them all in as radiology techs and then helped them get their licenses, get their practices going. My uncle, I remember, built a lot of their offices, you know, putting in the x-ray equipment for them.
Another uncle worked as an x-ray technician for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in Newark. Beginning in the early 1990s, Ken Weinberg toiled as an ER doc at Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck. He says the experience took a toll on his mental health.
I didn't realize how much I was acting out. I tried to keep myself healthy and deal with the brutality of working in an ER. And I don't think I always did it in a very healthy manner. You know, I developed PTSD from it, and I think it wasn't healthy. Because you get into a mentality, you're all in there together, and you just sort of accept this behavior, and you accept what goes on, and the worst things in people's lives are occurring in front of you, and you're doing all you can to improve them, and oftentimes you can't.
During his years in the ER, Weinberg often recorded his impressions of his encounters with patients on an iPad. Here's an excerpt of his reflections on an epileptic woman who came into the ER with a dislocated shoulder.
She's had 29 years of seizures. Nothing has worked. She's had 15 dislocations, both anterior and posterior of her shoulder. At the end of the month, she's going to Hackensack to have an ablative procedure, I guess, some kind of brain surgery.
The ER at Holy Name Hospital was run by a company called T-Neck Emergency Physicians. After Weinberg left the hospital, it was acquired by a company in Tennessee. He says his contract wasn't renewed after 22 years because a decision was made to maximize profits by hiring staff with less experience that could be paid less. Weinberg also worked in ERs in Hackensack and Woodbridge, as well as a number of urgent care centers in New Jersey and New York. One of the things that appealed to him about the urgent care work was that it made him feel like he was following in his grandfather's footsteps because the job entailed doing house calls. The house calls he did in Bergen County were a learning experience for the physician.
T-Neck had these beautiful old homes, well manicured out front, and then you'd walk in and it was extraordinary. The parents whose kids had grown up there were now infirm. Instead of living in their bedrooms on the second floor, they had all moved down into the living room. They'd be piles of newspapers. It would smell of urine. It was really depressing, but it gave me a sense of how perilous their lives were and how close to the edge they were living, even though from the outside it would look as if they had all kinds of means to be able to care for themselves, and they didn't.
Though Weinberg was a partner in an urgent care center in Edgewater that failed, he's been highly critical of the industry.
I'd go into work and there'd be no x-ray tech. There'd be no lab tech. You know, there wouldn't be enough supplies. And administrators didn't care, and then they knew that we'd make do. We'd work things out.
Some of the stories in Weinberg's memoir were previously published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine and the New York Times. His decades-long practice of writing about his patients is part of a discipline known as narrative medicine. It's an interdisciplinary approach to healthcare that emphasizes the importance of understanding and engaging with patients' personal stories. Fran Heller is a retired palliative care social worker who spent 18 years with Weinberg in a narrative medicine group at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in Manhattan.
Kenny is a very different kind of doctor because of everything he learned in narrative medicine, which is to say that he has the tools and the skills to read his patients and to listen to their stories. And I think that has really made him a much better diagnostician, which everybody knows in an emergency room setting is really crucial.
Dr. Weinberg is now part of a cannabis medical practice that is working with elderly patients suffering from dementia and autistic children. He's also doing telemedicine from his country home in upstate New York. His experience in emergency medicine and urgent care has transformed him into a vociferous advocate for single-payer universal health insurance. I asked him what he makes of the healthcare policy of the Trump administration.
The effects of all that's going on now with RFK and, you know, defunding research, it's going to get worse. People aren't going to be getting vaccines anymore. It's just extraordinary to me. It's really frightening as a physician to worry about what is going to happen.
Dr. Ken Weinberg, author of Exquisite Moments of Sorrow and Grace. He also writes a blog for Psychology Today titled Bedside Manners. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
This Voices of Wellness feature is made possible in part by a grant from the Horizon Foundation for New Jersey. StoryCorps' The Military Voices Initiative records and honors the stories of veterans, service members, and military families, ensuring their voices are heard and preserved for generations. Recording a conversation with a loved one or sharing personal reflections can be a powerful and memorable experience. Participants receive a copy of their conversation and have the option to archive it in StoryCorps' online archive and the Library of Congress. Very excited to tell you that WBGO and StoryCorps are inviting local veterans, military, and military families to participate in an upcoming audio recording event in the WBGO studios in Newark. StoryCorps is a nonprofit organization that aims to record, preserve, and share these stories from all backgrounds and beliefs. Its mission is to help us believe in each other by illuminating the humanity and possibility in us all, one story at a time. And joining us to talk about the Military Voices Initiative is Justin Cummins, the StoryCorps manager of the Military Voices Initiative. Great to see you, Justin.
Great to see you as well. Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. And also joining us is Michael D. Bowl, president of the New Jersey Veterans Network. Michael, thanks for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for this opportunity to share today.
So StoryCorps is something that Newark is very familiar with, as WBGO has partnered with StoryCorps in the past, Justin. Why did StoryCorps believe that this Military Voices Initiative had to take place?
Originally, StoryCorps launched the Military Voice Initiative in 2013. Our CEO, Sandra Clark, is the one who was the driving force behind that. And she came from a military family herself. And with all the work we've done, StoryCorps started in 2001. We were collecting all these oral histories of everyday people. And she asked the question of, why do we not have something for our veterans and our military families in these communities? Because oftentimes, you know, these voices do go unheard. It's people do their service and then that's it. And she saw the importance in it. And our founder, Dave Isay, believed the same thing. And so they put a lot of commitment and time into getting this program going. And now we've been running since 2013.
It is so important to document these stories because many times for us, we don't know the inside stories to our veterans. And so StoryCorps has been doing this. And this year, also Tampa is one of the locations that you have done, and Indianapolis, and now Newark. This is exciting stuff, Justin.
Yeah, I mean, every year we partner with three cities and with a local NPR station in each one of those cities. And we look for veteran organizations, the veteran community, seeing which communities are, you know, really building foundations for the veterans, military families, and doing the work on the ground. And I like to showcase that. We love coming into communities that are already like well-founded and have those great foundations, you know, projects like Michael's with the New Jersey Veterans Network. I mean, the work they're doing already is insurmountable. So being able to come in here or go in there and be able to uplift the voices that of these veterans who are doing these hard, you know, jobs of connecting people and getting people together, it's a great thing to build off of.
Michael Bowl has dedicated his entire life to charity and helping others. Following graduation from Union High School, he enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps and served in Operation Desert Storm. And now, as we mentioned, is the president of the New Jersey Veterans Network. I'm sure that this was an easy sell for you to be a part of the Military Voices Initiative, right, Michael?
Oh, absolutely. We've done something similar where we had Vietnam veterans and Korean War veterans come to schools and actually speak to the students. So they are unfortunately passing at this time, and the importance of this to keep this archive would be so important, and we could share it with so many people. So we would be honored to be a part of this and jumped on board almost instantaneously.
Your organization, Michael, is really a one-stop shop for veterans. Tell us how you've been able to help save lives, actually.
Well, one of the most important things is our charity has no ego. We work with anyone else in other organizations who have the same common mission. We aggressively seek out veterans and provide them free resources. One of the things that we're able to do is give away cars, housing, food, clothing. But the most important thing is our mentorship program, where we have peer support and where we're able to provide life-saving treatment. We have therapists on board. We're one big team where we're able to get people the resources they need almost as quickly as possible. Veterans who are able to share their story becomes a therapy for them. And this is so important to let their families know what they've been through. And it is hard sometimes to do it face to face. We feel that when you're doing it in a private setting, you're very comfortable to be able to speak about your experiences. It is a therapeutic thing for you, and also very, very important for your family to understand what you've been through. So that's why we really understand this a little bit more than other groups and really want to be a part of this.
For a while, I was a member of a softball team that was made up of all Vietnam veterans, and we would talk briefly about certain things, but then there were certain things that they wouldn't discuss and wouldn't talk about. And Justin, as Michael just mentioned, having that private setting, the way StoryCorps has you sit down and talk about your stories, it's inviting, it's intimate, and it's a welcoming thing. Talk about how it works, Justin.
Yeah, I would love to. So whenever you sign up, you'll come to the WBGO station. You're going to go into a recording room where you're going to see two mic stands set up. You're going to have a facilitator who is a trained facilitator. They've done hundreds of these conversations. We're also going to provide questions for y'all if y'all would like, but ultimately the questions are up to you and you can come in with a pre-prepared sheet. Once the conversation gets going, though, the facilitator just kind of removes himself from the conversation completely. We like to instill like a sense of intimacy between the two people who are participating rather than having a third party there interjecting, asking questions. You'd be surprised how quickly the mics disappear, how quickly the facilitator disappears, and you're just having a conversation with someone that you love, and it's a dedicated time to talk about whatever it is you want to talk about.
Justin Cummins, you mentioned it early in this interview when you talked about why wasn't there a StoryCorps collecting voices from the military? And it makes sense. Can this initiative open a lot of doors to more federal programming and funding of military operations and military families that are so deserving of their time and aid?
I believe it can. I mean, it's a hard thing to speak about right now, with current things that are going on. But ultimately, those who serve our country deserve our attention. They deserve the funding that keeps things going, whether it be from private donors or from, federal grants. I think we're going to see in the future that the more we get these programs out there and show people that we're doing this type of work, the more awareness it's going to bring and the more funding that will be put into these types of programs. Not to put too much of an urgency on it, but we only have 25 slots. So once those 25 slots are filled up, there is no room right now to add more. So if you would like to sign up, please do. And then there are also other ways that you can participate. You can also download the StoryCorps app and interview a loved one or a veteran that you know.
Michael, give us a little bit more about Operation Desert Storm for you.
So I was in the 6th Motor Transport Battalion, and our job was to drive anything from bombs to clothing, food, any supplies up to the different locations throughout the entire country. And I also got to ride a co-pilot with someone from a different country. I was their bodyguard, so I got to learn the culture and really be embedded with so many different people and really learning so much over there. So it was a great experience, and I got to bring it home and it helped me with my life.
Before we talk about your 25-year career in law enforcement, why did you want to be with the U.S. Marine Corps?
Hollywood has definitely had a factor growing up with Rambo and all these other type of action movies, but it was something I always wanted, and I actually wanted to be a Marine. That was no way I was thinking anything else. I couldn't wait. I joined immediately after high school, and it was the greatest decision I've ever made in my life.
What do you take with you in your law enforcement career that you learned as a member of the U.S. Marine Corps?
Both jobs are extremely similar. It's the unit, it's working together as a team, something bigger than yourselves aspect that I love the most. Being part of that really helped me move on with my life. I understand how both work. The Marines are the best of the best. And bringing that to the police department, I was able to do some really wonderful things because of that.
So, Justin, the online archive and the Library of Congress, can you tell us a little bit how some of these interviews may make it to that point?
All of them will, depending on the participant's decision. After they are done recording, they get to determine whether they want to release this interview to be stored on our online archive. That's at storycorps.org. And also sent to the Library of Congress. People have complete autonomy on what they decide, but once the interview is collected, it will be uploaded to the archive, as well as sent a copy of the Library of Congress and a copy sent to both participants. And it'll be there forever. I mean, long-term storage. I mean, I don't think you can ask for anything better than that for your legacy to go on.
It's a wonderful thing. MVI will host in-person recording days at WBGO July 30th through August 3rd, and then virtual recording days are August 6th through the 10th. Justin, thanks for joining us today and congratulations on the Military Voices Initiative, especially here in Newark.
I appreciate that.
Michael, thank you for your service and congratulations on all the work that you've been doing, not only as a veteran, but a member of the Union Police Department. Your life is always about helping others.
Thank you for having this opportunity to have me here today, and God bless the United States of America.
You can register to tell your military story at WBGO by going to our website, wbgo.org. The 16th Annual Women's International Film Festival is presented by Women in Media Newark and its Executive Director, Pamela Morgan, who joins us today, along with one of the most outstanding filmmakers in the world. One of the most anticipated films in this festival will take place at the Newark Public Library on August 2nd at 10 a.m. Bomb Bomb, The Sister Nancy Story, directed by Canadian film director, producer, and writer, and co-founder of Oya Media. Allison Duke is here. Great to have you on the show, Allison.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here with you and Pam. Pamela, sorry.
It's okay.
Absolutely. It's an honor to talk to you. This film, as I mentioned, so many people are already talking about it. It's fun, it's inspirational, and it needs to be told. The story of Jamaican DJ and singer Sister Nancy and the reggae anthem Bom Bom.
Bom bom
bom bom
bom bom
bom bom
bom bom.
It's in commercials, it's in movies, it's in TV shows. She should have been making millions of dollars.
I decided I have to fight for what is rightfully mine.
This woman,
the queen of dancehall music.
Now, you and I spoke briefly before we started. You were a fan of Sister Nancy before this project even started.
Oh, yes. I'm of the age when I was actually at the basement parties when they used to like drop Sister Nancy records for the first time. So, way back then, I've been listening to Sister Nancy. And I just remember, back then the environment of a basement party, in Toronto, Canada, it was such a multicultural and very Caribbean, focused space that we'd all go to on the weekends just to party, have a good time, congregate. And the DJs used to play music in sets. They'll play like the R&B set, the funk set, because there was funk music back then, and soul music, some slow jams, and then they'd play a reggae set. And they'd play a calypso set. And so when the reggae set came on, all you would hear was like all these men's voices, like on the records. And you'd hear very few female voices. You might hear some singers. And then there would be Sister Nancy. And when they put Sister Nancy record on, They, all of us women in the basement party, we would just go like nuts, like, because we were so, we felt seen, we felt heard. Her voice competed with men, the male records that were coming out, and also was even better, right? And so we just felt proud to be young females in the party. She was speaking about the things that we wanted to hear, like women's empowerment, and, you know, making sure that you know that you should be confident as a young woman. And so they played that record over and over again to the point where people would say, okay, you got to stop.
Yeah. And what was the moment where you said, I want to be the person to tell Sister Nancy's story?
Well, Sister Nancy, if you watch the film, you'll see that she's got promoters and DJs from around the world. And she has a DJ that's been working with her for 17 years. Now, when I say DJ, I mean like the person who's playing the records. Well, when she's DJing in the mic, that's what Jamaicans call it. Anyways, his name is Mossman, and he came to us. He came to Oya Media Group, my film company. He came to me because he knew that I produced music videos back in the day, direct music videos, and also documentaries about music and musicians. And so, I was just working late one night, and I got a phone call from him, like, "Hey, I want to make this documentary about a legend in the dancehall world." And I was interested, but he didn't really tell me who it was until a couple conversations later. And then he said, "Okay, I think you're the right person to make this film, but Sister Nancy has to like you." Now, if you've seen this film, you would know I immediately got nervous. First of all, I didn't even know she was alive when he asked me this. But then I got really nervous, and then we got a call with her one day. I just remember it like yesterday. We were in the middle of the office, with interns around and everything, and we called her, and she said hi to everyone, and we had a tremendous conversation for about an hour, and she, at the end of it, she said, "I think you're the one to do it."
What a validation of your work, right? To receive that phone call, that has to make you feel like everything that you've accomplished, to connect with someone who you admired and you looked up to as an artist, comes to you and says, "Yeah, I want you to be the one to tell my story." I mean, that's unbelievable.
It's incredible. I feel honored. I feel blessed to be able to tell anybody's story. But Sister Nancy is a voice that I grew up with, and she brought me so much joy in my life as a young person. And to be able, 40 years later, to be the person helming her project as a director, and getting a up close witness into her life and into her story. Wow. I pinch myself and I'm grateful.
What does Sister Nancy mean to Pam Morgan?
Great question, Doug. I think that Sister Nancy transcends the barriers. I think she's more than a Caribbean legend. I think that she has affected all of us, because I remember too hearing Sister Nancy and seeing how excited, the community got whenever her music would come on. And that's one of the reasons that we're really excited and grateful to Allison for allowing us to screen this film.
Yeah, and when we hear about these iconic artists and to find their background is always fascinating to me. How much work and research had to go into this, Allison?
Wow. A lot of research. I have to be thankful to our visual researcher, Amy Fritz, who was supportive of that. And also our music, our composer, who was also helpful. We had many conversations about the music, about the cadence, about the rhythm, a graphic designer, like everybody was involved in that conversation. But I did a lot of research. And the first thing I did was map out all the songs that had sampled Sister Nancy. And at one point I came up to this was years back, ago, I came up to 189, at that point. And I created a list. And I not only just created the list, I listened to every single song and how they sampled it and where. Like some of it would be like, you know, they would sample the hook, like the bomb bomb. And I love the way you say bomb bomb because that's the correct way to saying it, Douglas. Doug. You know, they would sample the hook. Sometimes they would sample a little bit of the verse. They might do something like what Kanye did, was like speed up her, you know, her cadence, her delivery, in his song Famous. And it actually inspired me to think about, you know, why they wanted to use her voice.
You can get the entire Women in Media Newark's Women's International Film Festival lineup at WIM-N.com. You can see my entire interview with Allison Duke and Pamela Morgan on the WBGO YouTube channel. Thanks for joining us on the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO at WBGO.org.